This is the BBC. For details of our complete range of programmes, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Welcome to the latest global news, recorded at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 9th of November. I'm Emilio San Pedro with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, President Trump strikes a warmer tone on the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China on the second day of his visit to Beijing, placing the blame on previous U.S. administrations.
Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one, but I don't blame China.
Concerns grow over how the Saudi blockade of its borders with Yemen could have an impact on the humanitarian crisis there.
It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
Researchers have discovered that burns and cuts sustained during the daytime heal more quickly than injuries which happen overnight.
There was a very clear time of day effect in how well fibroblast cells migrate into the wound and start to repair it.
And
to be a Getty is an extraordinary thing.
The actor Kevin Spacey, who's faced a series of allegations of sexual harassment, is now being removed from a movie he's already filmed. But first, North Korea and trade took center stage on President Trump's second day in Beijing, with the U.S. and China announcing they'd signed deals in excess of $250 billion. And Mr. Trump was far less aggressive, warm even, on a topic he often grilled China over on the campaign trail last year, the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China. Speaking to reporters in Beijing today, Mr. Trump put the blame on former U.S. administrations instead.
Both the United States and China will have a more prosperous future if we can achieve a level economic playing field. Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But I don't blame China.
President Xi said China and the U.S. could work together going forward.
At present, Sino-US relations are at a new historical starting point. China is willing to work with the United States to respect each other, offer mutual benefits, focus on cooperation, and manage and control our differences.
Stephen McDonnell is part of the BBC team in Beijing.
The remarkable thing is this change of language from the US president. These comments here are so much more conciliatory compared to those on the campaign trail when he was saying that China was raping the US economy. Here we have him with a much more conciliatory tone. So both he and Xi Jinping have been praising one another. I mean, from the Chinese side, they're saying that the Trump administration is responsible for opening up a new era in China-US relations. And Xi Jinping has also promised, I mean, if there's any sort of breakthrough, it's this, promised to open up the Chinese economy to other companies from overseas, especially US companies. And if we take him at his word, that would be a shift.
But what kind of deals, if any, were actually made?
As if to prove that this is the dawning of a new era, they announced $250 billion worth of deals between Chinese and US companies. Now, the thing is that in the coming days, all the financial press will be unpacking these deals and seeing what, you know, they really mean, because some of them are more like what you'd call in the memorandum of understanding camp, and yet others do actually represent, you know, orders, if you like. I mean, you know, they're talking about Boeing, for example, selling planes and more soybeans specifically coming from the US into China. And so the specifics of it will be worked out. And again, it will be for others to judge, just, you know, if it's fair enough to really say this is a $250 billion breakthrough, or whether or not this is just a little exaggerated, because some of these are just sort of promises and may not ever eventuate.
Now, before arriving in China, President Trump was quite hard on China and others for their dealings with North Korea. He said that had to stop. Has he made any headway in that regard?
I don't think he's made any headway. I mean, here, for example, this morning, he came out and again said that China if it really wanted to, could quickly and easily fix the North Korean nuclear problem. And he also said that now is the time for this region to be rid of the menace of the North Korean nuclear threat. Now, it's unclear whether he was suggesting regime change in North Korea, or is he just talking about the nuclear weapons? Now, if he's talking about toppling the government there, then China would not go along with that, because they don't want North Korea to collapse, to have a unified Korea with the potential of the South dominating that and US troops on the border with China. If he's talking about getting rid of nuclear weapons in North Korea, well, yeah, China is totally on board with that, and they're saying that we're fully implementing all of the UN sanctions and, you know, hoping that that's going to work.
Stephen McDonnell. Exactly 12 months ago today, Americans woke up to find Donald Trump had defied all predictions and had become their president. Since then, there's been not one major legislative achievement. Plenty of tweets, though, 2,470 to be exact. And according to one poll, 7 in 10 Americans believe the nation's political divisions are now as bad as during the Vietnam War. The BBC's Jim Nocketty charts the highs and lows of the Trump presidency so far.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 9th of November.
We can now say with confidence at 25 minutes to 8 that the 45th President of the United States will be Donald Trump.
It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me.
One phrase dominated: America first. It didn't bother him that that had been the slogan of the pro-Hitler isolationists before the Second World War. For him, it was simple.
I think a year from now, people are like, whoa, this guy is totally different than what all that fear-mongering was. And this is a guy that can run the country because he'll surround himself with the right people.
Anthony Scaramucci, New York financier, Trump supporter, who told me a few days before the election that the candidate had assured his staff that he would stop tweeting if he was elected.
Sir Elton John had a great line about Donald Trump. He said that he is the best live stage performer that can't sing or play a musical instrument.
And it was true. He was determined to be the entertainer, even in the Oval Office. The crowd would be pleased. Everyone at the New York Times was a liar. The Mexican wall would go up. The swamp would be drained. Obamacare would go.
In a few moments, I will sign an executive order and people will have great, great health care.
Of course, it wasn't so easy. Health reform foundered when the Republicans on the Hill found it was difficult to take away something that many people who'd got it wanted to keep. And the White House seemed to have a top-speed revolving door. General Flynn lasted a few weeks as National Security Advisor before having to admit that he'd lied to the Vice President. The press secretary was fired. Anthony Scaramucci came in as communications chief and was sacked within a week. Washington had never seen anything quite like it.
America will start winning again.
It was clear within the first few months that Donald Trump was indeed Donald Trump and no one else. And for every American liberal who said that the country was more divided than at any time since the Civil War, a favourite jibe, the president would find another football stadium to fill with cheering supporters and promise him the America they dreamed of. A year on, that support is shrinking. Not spectacularly, but going down. The new Washington, with a hugely weakened and depopulated State Department dealing with foreign policy, and Republican leaders in Congress constantly under fire from the White House, seems increasingly strange. President Trump is on a journey in office as unpredictable as the one he took on as a candidate. But will it have, for him, a happy ending? The man who may hold the key to that is the former FBI director whom many call the most powerful man in Trump's Washington, the special counsel, Robert Mueller.
Well, he's very, very good friends with Comey, which is very bothersome, but we're going to have to see.
Exactly. The off-year election results on Tuesday weren't at all good for the president, but his bigger worries are about money deals, Russia, and the troublesome, determined Mr. Mueller.
That report from Jim Nocketty. More than 500,000 people have fled northern Rakhine State after Myanmar's military-led operation, and they continue to arrive in the refugee camps of Bangladesh. Aid agencies are calling for more protection for women and children who they say are in danger of being trafficked from the camps. Nomia Iqbal is at one of the largest near the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar.
There's about more than 22,000 people that live here, one of the largest refugee camps. It's supported by the government, so it's a lot more organised in comparison to the other camps. Certainly in the last few months, many have been springing up because 500,000 Rohingya people have fled over here to the border. This camp has a slight market-style feel to it. It's a very, very busy camp. You see young mums with their children carrying vegetables. You see young boys playing football. But it takes about an hour to get over here from the heart of Cox's Bazar. And the journey here is really eye-opening because you go past lush forests, large paddy fields. There's a long stretch of unbroken sandy beaches. And as you approach the area where these refugee camps are, and they're all really close to each other, the green hills fade and you see these rows and rows of tents made from bamboo sticks and plastic sheets. It's a real breathtaking contrast, and you see it. You see the refugee crisis, hundreds of thousands of refugees walking around in an area which is unfamiliar to them. This is not their home. All these people have either witnessed or experienced brutal violence, rape, their homes being burnt down, and they come here for safety. But we've been hearing that their troubles, unfortunately, don't end once they're here on this side of the border. I met a 21-year-old girl called Halima. She fled northern Rakhine back in August when the military moved in. She arrived here alone. She came for safety. But she's now been forced into prostitution after being taken out of the camps. I met her in a quiet place in Cox's Bazar where she now lives. What she says is distressing.
As we entered into the Bangladesh, we were taken to this Unchi Prang camp. So there, a local Bangladeshi man, he came and told me that he lost his wife and he has two kids. He wanted to marry me. He gave us some food and I believed him. He told me that he would take me to his uncle's house in Cox's Bazar city. So I went with him. In this house, I saw 7 to 8 girls like me. So I was scared. In that house, he forced me to have sex with different men.
How long did you stay with this man and in this house for?
I stayed at that house for 2 months. I was dolled up and I had this makeup. They brought men and I had to sleep with them. Sometimes 3 to 4 people used to come in one night. Then one day, a man, I heard he's a police from Bangladesh. He came. I told him what happened to me. At first, he came for having sex with me, but after hearing my stories, he called me his sister. And this guy stayed overnight, but he did nothing with me. Instead, he wrote his phone numbers and gave it to me. One night, a man came for having sex with me. I asked him if I could call to my parents because I was missing them. So he gave me his mobile phone and I called that policeman on his number. I told him that they're beating me and I'm bleeding. So this guy told me that he would come with his forces and don't worry. So in the midnight, the police came with 6 other policemen, rescued me with other girls. He told me that you are free now. So as I don't know any place in Bangladesh, I came here in Cox's Bazar again. As I have no any source of income, I have no choice but being a prostitute.
I can see that you're very thin. You're clearly not well. I can tell just how distressing this is for you to talk about. And you're so young, you're only 21. What do you want to have in life?
I used to have a life in Myanmar. I want to pray 5 times per day, having meals with my family. I want the life I had before with my family in Myanmar.
A 21-year-old Rohingya refugee called Halima, ending that report by Nomia Iqbal in Bangladesh. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says he's very concerned about the dangers of sexual exploitation people like Halima face, but that it will take a long time before conditions are right for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh to return to Myanmar.
When people are come with nothing, they're extremely vulnerable to this type of protection risks. So we are focusing with specific activities, personnel on these aspects. The other feature of this particular crisis that struck me immensely when I was there is the intensity and level of trauma that people carry with them. They've witnessed terrible violence, especially children that have seen parents killed in front of their eyes, women that have been raped or that have suffered attempted rape and severe wounds. I found, for example, people to be very passive, not to have strong reaction, almost numb to pain. And this is really an indication of severe trauma, which will take a long time to be healed.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. The trailer is already out for the Hollywood movie All the Money in the World.
To be a Getty is an extraordinary thing. What's your name? My grandfather wasn't just the richest man in the world. Who's your daddy? He was the richest man in the history of the world.
All the Money in the World follows the kidnapping of 16-year-old John Paul Getty III and the desperate attempt by his devoted mother, Gail, to convince his billionaire grandfather to pay the ransom. It was due to come out next month, but its producer, Sony, is making some last-minute adjustments. The American actor, Kevin Spacey, is to be erased from the film following allegations of predatory sexual behavior against him. Tom Burridge told me more.
Well, All the Money in the World, in the film, Kevin Spacey was due to star John Paul Getty. Now, he was a US oil tycoon, once the richest man in the world. His grandson was kidnapped back in 1973, and the film is centred around the kidnapping of his grandson and the efforts made or not by John Paul Getty to get him back and whether or not he ultimately pays a ransom to the kidnappers. So Kevin Spacey had a role in that film, quite an important role. From the trailer we just heard, it doesn't seem that he was the prominent two roles, but he definitely featured quite heavily in the film. It looks like a pretty high budget movie, pretty big names. We've actually spoken to Valentina Viola. She's one of the actresses in the movie. She stars alongside Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg. And she said she really is kind of unsure about the decision to remove Kevin Spacey from a remade version.
I think that everything is going a little bit crazy right now. So I don't know if this is right, but I think it's not, because I like Kevin Spacey as an actor. He's a legend to me. Probably if they took this decision, it is good for the movie.
That's debatable, I suppose. But is this the end for Kevin Spacey?
Yeah, hard to say. I mean, look, if you just list what's happened in the light of the allegations, remember the first allegation came to light at the end of last month that a fellow actor, Anthony Rapp, alleged that Spacey made a sexual advance at him. Spacey said that he couldn't remember, but he did apologise if he had done anything wrong. Now, since then, you've seen Netflix cancel House of Cards series. Of course, Kevin Spacey starring in that. You've got the Academy of TV and Arts and Sciences announced Spacey will no longer receive an Emmy Award. And now I think this move from Sony. Now, Sony have obviously thought long and hard about this decision. It wouldn't have been easy, but I guess they want to avoid people boycotting the film if they objected to the severity of the allegations against Kevin Spacey and him appearing in it. And I guess, you know, the fact that we're all talking about this movie today, we've all watched the trailer now, and it looks quite an intriguing film, if I'm honest. You know, Sony are probably generating more publicity ultimately for their movie.
Tom Burridge, you're listening to Global News, the most important stories and the best interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend, you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and the programme is also available to download from our website, bbc.co.uk/programmes. Now.
It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
That's the sober warning from the UN's aid chief, Mark Lowcock, about the situation in Yemen. It follows the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies in their battle to defeat Houthi rebels backed by Iran. The BBC's Nawal Al-Magafi has reported from Yemen several times.
The situation in Yemen is already very, very dire. I've made, you know, frequent trips for the last 3 years, and it's shocking to me how much worse the situation gets every time we go. First, it was the bombing. Then we were looking at the horrifying pictures of starvation, and then the worst cholera epidemic of our lifetime. And the idea now that all life-saving aid will be stopped completely is just terrifying.
How many people are affected at the moment?
So right now, 7 million people are on the brink of famine. And these numbers are at a time where stuff was coming in, aid and food was coming in. And 900,000 people infected with cholera. Just today, the Red Cross said that a ship containing chlorine tablets, which means tablets that will chlorinate the water, have been stopped. So that means that it will start to spread a whole lot faster.
And Yemen is, in effect, part of a regional power struggle between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Exactly. I've been speaking to people on the ground yesterday in Yemen, and they're completely against the missile that was launched by the Houthi rebels into Riyadh. And in effect, they're the ones that end up paying the highest price for this conflict between the two regional powers.
The BBC's Nawal Al-Maghafi. Saudi Arabia is still reeling after dozens of influential figures, including 11 princes, were arrested last weekend. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says he's cracking down on corruption, but his critics worry that too much power is becoming concentrated in his hands. The Crown Prince, who's 32, often presents himself as carrying out reforms on behalf of Saudi Arabia's young population. So what do young Saudis think about the direction their country is now heading in? Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell has been finding out.
Saudi Arabia remains rigidly conservative, but it's striving to be modern. Its young population is restless for reform. 6 in 10 Saudis are aged under 30. So what do they think of the latest dramatic changes being ordered by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman?
The sense that I got from my Saudi friends and the Saudi public sphere as well, which, you know, you can tap into on Twitter, there was elation.
Ali Shaban from Riyadh is studying in Washington, D.C., but he's enthusiastically following what's going on back home.
The people that have been arrested have always been deemed to be untouchable. And so this sends a message that that is over and that no one is untouchable and there will be no tolerance anymore for corruption and waste in the economy.
Since his rapid rise to power, the Crown Prince has been promoting his new Saudi Vision 2030. He has plans to diversify the oil-reliant economy, build a megacity in the desert, and fight corruption. Many Saudis, resentful of how much of the country's wealth has long remained in the hands of the royals and their close associates, see this positively. But you don't have to look for long online before you find dissenting Saudi voices. A satirical cartoon suggests Mohammed bin Salman is just consolidating his own power, laughing as he locks his royal cousins in a cage. Recent days have seen many other changes in Saudi Arabia, including in its conservative culture. A loosening of tight restrictions on women allows some to join the audience at this extreme sports show for the first time. But while many young Saudis are applauding such steps, for now, the direction the country is taking looks very uncertain.
Yolande Nell. News now of another interesting development shedding new light on the importance of our internal body clocks. Last week, research suggested that patients having open-heart surgery coped better when having their operation in the afternoon. Now, another study seems to show that wounds heal more quickly if you get them during the day rather than at night. It was carried out by the British sleep expert Dr. John O'Neill from the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge.
Most people are aware of their body clock. It's the reason that we feel sleepy at nights. It's the thing that gets confused when we suffer from jet lag. But not many people are aware of the fact that there's a biological clock in every cell of the body. In particular, skin cells, which was the basis of our study. And we were really interested in how skin cells use their biological clock to time the kind of processes that skin cells do, such as repairing damaged skin. What we found was that both in a Petri dish where the biological clock ticks away perfectly well all by itself, as well as in skin slices and using mouse models, there was a very clear time of day effect in how well fibroblast cells, which are the particular type of skin cell which are very important for wound healing, there was a very clear time of day effects in how well those cells migrate into the wound and start to repair it. We were fortunate enough to be able to work with clinical scientists in Manchester who had access to a burns database. In fact, on average, it required 18 days for burn injuries to heal if they occurred during the day, compared with 28 days when they occurred during the night.
To Zimbabwe now, where the main airport has been officially renamed. Harare International will now be known as Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport. The veteran leader, now 93 years old, has ruled the country since 1980. The BBC's Shingai Nyoka went to the official opening ceremony.
It was a very simple ceremony. President Mugabe and his wife Grace arrived at the airport. They pulled back the curtains that with the plaque, with the new name for the international airport. Some of the finishing touches are still going on. They're still changing or putting his name on top of the tower. But it was essentially a very simple ceremony. And he thanked the party as well as the government for the honor and said that it wasn't just an honor for himself, but also for his family and for the people of Zimbabwe. This particular name change came about because of the ruling party. A few years ago, they said that they wanted to honor President Mugabe while he was still alive. And what they've said is that they also plan to honor him by creating a public holiday on his birthday from next year, as well as building a $1 billion university, a science and technology university. There's been widespread criticism given the state of the economy. Many people didn't think that renaming the airport was a priority. They spent about $10 million that's going to be spent in upgrading this airport, and they don't believe that that's a priority.
Shingai Nyoka. Radio stations in Canada have been given official permission to turn the air blue, or rather bleu, as a ruling that a particular swear word is fine to transmit only applies to French language stations. Jonathan Savage explains.
So this is a story about a radio station being allowed to use a word which I'm not allowed to use on this radio station. So let's just say the word is not fudge. It all started earlier this year when Montreal's French language radio station CKOI-FM broadcast the word that isn't fudge on two separate occasions. One was a clip of the singer Madonna not saying fudge during a women's march against President Trump. In the other, Billie Joe Armstrong, the lead singer of Green Day, didn't say fudge during an excerpt from a concert. Some people complained to the Canadian Broadcasting Standards Council, who had previously classified the word that isn't fudge as only being suitable for adults in both French and English. This meant that you could only not say fudge beyond an evening watershed, and even then with a warning that the word fudge was not going to be used. But on this occasion, the station argued back. It said that the word was part of the common French spoken language and therefore doesn't have the same vulgar connotations when used in French. And the CSBC agreed. So whether you're saying the words that aren't fudge or fudging or fudged, as long as it's not part of an insult at a particular person, linguistically sensitive French Canadians will just have to put up with it. Whatever you think about that decision, you certainly can't accuse them of fudging the issue.
You certainly can't. Jonathan Savage, and there's so much fudge in there, don't know where to begin. That's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download later, presented by Jackie Leonard, who I'm afraid won't have any fudge. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.